You are listening to Jaya Ashmore. You can find hundreds of meditations and talks on my websites, jayaashmore.org, jayaashmore.org, as well as opendharma.org, opendharma.org. All the recordings are offered in the tradition of generosity or dana, and your gifts are welcome. Thank you for listening. I'd like to start with just a couple of practical things about the schedule, including a little bit more information about the meditative movement at 6:20. So first of all, we slightly changed the schedule from usual to give a little bit more of a break between the end of the meditative movement time and the first meditation of the day together, which starts at 7:30. And that's because there's not a bathroom nearby, so you can have actually time to go to the bathroom, and even if someone else is in there, you can have time to wait in line and come back. And if you don't need to go to the bathroom, it also can be a really lovely time if you come to the movement, which we do inside for privacy, to have some of that glorious early morning time before coming back into the hall for the meditation, or just to stay for a longer meditation. It's not even quite an hour. It's 55 minutes or so, which means it's a great way to start the day remembering, if you leave the hall and come back in, that you can do that as silently as a leopard. Sometimes, if we don't realize, it can start to sound like a train station in the halls. And this hall has this exquisite quality of carrying sound, which can be a torture. If someone's really, I'm gonna just stay and meditate the whole time till breakfast. And then people stepping over them, you know, coming in and like, the shawl or the cushion from, you know, we could do someday a nice percussion experiment as an awareness exercise of sound, but most of the time it's more about the silent side here. So it can be so interesting to notice how every little thing that we do affects inwardly and outwardly. And there's some part of us, I think, with sort of the mainstream culture that has really a hard time with that. Like we want to come and have my retreat. And here you have the encouragement to feel for your own way. So to really experiment, and it's not just falling into a sort of obedience to what the teacher says to do, or rebellion to what the teacher says to do, but to really have like ample room to experiment. And that sounds really good in one way, a little scary in another way. But then to experiment and know that everything we do affects not only me, but all of you, it can be really annoying sometimes to not be able to just go to one extreme or the other. So giving the chance to go out of the hall during the break in the morning before the first meditation, or to stay in, and either way to really leave that amazing morning quality by if you leave, just leaving quietly, if you come back in, coming back in quietly. So as Anetaji said, the meditative movement time I'll be leading in the morning, and it's weird. It's not, again, I'm not gonna be showing you what to do, like, okay, no, a little bit higher on the right, no. We'll warm up. Sometimes there'll be some music, sometimes not. And it's improvised movement. And it comes from the teachings of a woman named Bonnie Bainbridge Cohen, and she calls it body-mind centering, but it's especially embodied anatomy is the basis of the movement that we'll be doing. And so it in some ways really, really simple. We could just now, for example, feel the physical heart and notice what happens when I say the word heart, physical heart. What comes to mind? Do you have a picture in your mind? Do you have the word heart in mind? What happens? And then actually going into that location, embodying that location, and being in that thing that we call heart, and dropping the word heart and the image of the heart, which hopefully none of us have actually seen our own heart. So coming into what we can actually directly know of that thing that we call heart. And from there, you could just sit against the wall and move your hand up and back down. So it doesn't, you don't have to be a dancer or acrobat. So that's the basic idea. And if you want to do your own yoga or your own movement practice, you can do that at that time or at another time. So for example, when I go on retreat, I like to do my own yoga as well. And I usually like to join the movement of the retreat as well. So that means usually getting up a bit earlier because I like to do it in the morning, or finding a time in the afternoon to do your own thing. Feel very free not to come at all. If you are tired and hesitate to get up so early tomorrow morning, please do anyway. Get up and come, because I'll be giving the more full instructions tomorrow morning, and through the week, hopefully going towards less words in the meditative movement time. So if you've come the first time, you'll have the basic idea of how we play. It's not interactive. It's not like what's the word? Contact improvisation. It's not contact, physical contact with other people. It's physical contact with yourself, and giving space, and not even watching or being watched with other people. So it's kind of safe in that way, and challenging in many ways. But there will be music, maybe more often than on some other retreats. So are there any questions so far? So I'm very happy to be here with you. It's a place I can't believe still exists, both retreat and this several hundred acres of forest. And each year it could be that it is the last year also, the way things are going. And so I would ask you to consider including just the fact of being here as a major part of your retreat. Not just enjoying the lovely sights, but a few specific things about the nature. And maybe most simply and most importantly could be the possibility of, just by being here, letting the body kind of open in a bodily way to its physical and living surroundings. So like the substance of the body, the living cells of the body, opening and remembering their living cellular nature in resonance with all this living cellular nature that we're in the midst of. And letting that bring us back into a more natural rhythm, or to more natural rhythms, more than one. That different kind of layers of our being may have different speeds and different kind of patterns of movement. And just letting the nature call us back in to ourselves, out of the habit ways that we've gotten into being disconnected. Does that make sense? It's very simple. It could sound kind of far out, but it's far out because our culture is so extreme. So it can kind of feel like letting the body listen and be listened to. Letting the body sense and be sensed. And I don't think it's something that needs a lot of conscious, like, prompting. Like, I don't think we have to kind of keep pushing ourselves to be here and absorb and get absorbed into nature, but just noticing that that could be a really big thing for a person who's used to the mainstream culture to just be here for a while. It may really call us into aliveness and silence. In ways that, by contrast, are easy to feel, and that can give a lot to our practice. It can really tell us what needs attention and what knows easily how to release. And just another, maybe smaller, encouragement about being in this nature is possibility to be open to the fact that this is one of the last kind of refuges of this kind in this country, and certainly in this area. And so the beauty and privilege of being in that, and also the sadness of that. Just by being open to the possibility that sadness could come, that animals are hungry, and that it doesn't have to be a, it doesn't have to break you. And we maybe don't have to block that feeling if it happens. It can be important to leave room for that. Does that make sense? And to bring it in to the meditation retreat, that we're not like pretending we're somewhere else or pretending that this is some kind of island of something somewhere, can then help bring that connection, the sensing and being sensed, and the listening and being listened to, and that tasting of where exactly we are right now, sort of as humanity and a planet. Not in an alarmist way, not in a one-sided way. And that's what's maybe important about being here, is with the sadness is the beauty, with the beauty can be the sadness. And that's different from just bad news. And so then it can come with us when we leave here, a different sense of where we are as humanity on this planet. I think one thing that can happen whether we have a sense of connection to a religion or not is maybe more fully accepting again where we are as humanity on the planet, also in terms of our perspective on what all this is. So, just in the last 100 years or so, the realizations of, like, that there's almost 100 billion galaxies. And each one with billions of stars. You know, That wasn't in anybody's mind 100 years ago. They had other things in their mind, but that wasn't. And there can be a kind of simplification, like if we would get the, it's like coming into focus, like, whoa, we're allowed to feel awe about that. That is really something. And that all of it is moving around. We didn't know that either, not so long ago. There were the ideas of the earth in the middle and then the sun in the middle, but the sun staying still and everything going around it. And then, okay, well, the solar system is moving around. Okay, but actually the galaxy is moving around, the center of the galaxy. Probably we'll find out soon that our little universe is just this one little universe among so many universes that's also moving around. So where there might be some sense of looking for what is in the center and hoping that's going to stay still and be that still thing in the center that everything else goes around. And maybe there is something like that. And maybe there isn't. And so then, where do we find stillness? And what is our experience of center? And maybe experiences of awe. Do you know this word awe? I didn't check much about your English or my English. Is that okay? Do you know what awe means? No? What's awe in German? Any idea? So awe for me is easy. Like, go outside after this. We'll turn off the lights if we can figure out how to turn that light off. And see the stars and be like, oh my God. Whoa. It sounds like a German root word. Yeah? No, it's not.
Unglaublich.
Unglaublich.
Unglaublich. It's more incredible, but
it is
Ehrfurcht. Ehrfürchtiges Staunen. Awe.
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 It's not a German.
No?
It's an expression, just awe.
Yeah, also onomatopoetic.
Demut.
Demut? No? So, awe is not a feeling that I'm in control. That's one part of it. It's a feeling that having accepted, that having noticed that I'm not in control, there's something really big happening. And I don't know if it's going to be okay or not. But it doesn't seem necessarily to be the end of everything. And then there can be a more pleasant kind of awe that's just like, whoa, feeling very much a part of that bigness and that friend a friendliness with not being in control, like more like thank God, thank goodness I'm not in control. And that I'm part of something bigger that is smarter than me. But I feel like even the gesture that could be like, oh, the stars. But it could even be like a tree, but it could easily be like, ooh. But it could also be like, oh. And it just feels like the arms like also bring into a center. Like opening to all that, like, oh, without any control or without much control. So there's humility and wow, it's big. And it's beautiful and scary. There's not that one statement that could be made about it. You can try it when, maybe now or when no one's looking. Whatever, like, it's almost like bringing or pointing or pouring or opening some kind of center that isn't self-centered. And what I would wish for in our world, maybe most of all, is that there would be more awe. I think religions have gotten confused about awe, and then anti-religion has gotten maybe lost track of awe. And so then, like science, the scientists, when they are talking personally, often talk about awe, but when they're talking professionally, not so much. Unless they're real groundbreakers. And then they'll be interviewed because they're that weird scientist that will talk about awe. And not knowing is included there. And so it just feels like that kind of adjusting of different experiences as the lenses, but then it just click, oh, it's clear. With maybe this missing ingredient of awe. Is there another language that we need to find what awe is in? That language? And then along the lines of awe and being in tune with nature, we can maybe come in contact with not just like how cute, how sweet, how romantic, how nice. And also not just like, oh my God, how rough. But just a place in us that's really simple with birth and death and the in-between. It doesn't seem to work well to keep death and birth, but especially death, sort of like way over there until we get to it. It does seem to work well to kind of keep close with depth. Not to romanticize, but to keep close. And that can be even in these minute, kind of small, subtle, so the end of the out-breath, the end of the in-breath, the end of a thought, the end of a day. And then that might help us be more fresh for the beginning of the out-breath, the in-breath, the day. And maybe that sort of impersonalness of accepting that we are made of birth and death. Our experience is made of birth and death. There's not going to be birth and death. That kind of really bare, clear presence. Somewhere in our presence where we do accept. We accept that living, imagining some kind of life without death that can put death off. Is bad medicine. And so it's not like, oh, I really want to be in touch with, but it just is. From there, maybe there can be a dropping down, so to speak, even further into a sense of the deathless. Into an experiential sense of the deathless. So an experiential sense of something beyond biology. Something that informs or inhabits or sparks or something with biology. Plays with biology. That helps so much when we're going inward, and then, let's say, for example, there might be so many movies going on in the mind, and the sort of impersonal, bare place, and being in touch with something that has a little sense of humor about biology. But it's these funny little shapes that happen. And funny that we think of it as me when you also have and I didn't make it, you know. And you didn't make your knee and I didn't make my elbow, and they're funny little shapes. And so this kind of glorious expanse of experience that can happen of how many knees there are and have been and may there be. And may we take care and have a sense of humor. And same with our thoughts and our habits and our emotions. And the expanse of feeling that the more personal and private and embarrassing that we think it is, the more common. The more you can be sure everyone in the room knows exactly what you're talking about. And so what if we would just, like the magician that can take the cloth off the table without crashing the dishes to the ground? Just take out the embarrassment. And then just what happens? All the same stuff on the same table without embarrassment. The same emotion, the same story in the mind, the same past. Same body. Same parents. Same children, whatever. Without embarrassment or pride, with four, like taking it as if I did it. So that's the experiment I propose for the week. And that includes finding out for yourself what might support your experiment. And then, what is embarrassment, and where does it come from? Like, what is it made of? Where does it start out? Why? Someone that we feel more closely associated with does something that we don't like, that's maybe socially unacceptable, and we feel embarrassed. Whereas if it would be someone we didn't know, maybe we think they're from another country, another culture, and we would just think, oh, they didn't know. They just did that thing that's socially unacceptable. Are there any questions or anything to share?
Somebody said embarrassment was when you got more love than you thought you were worth. So you kind of send a surge of energy out, push it away.
I think that sense of worth is involved also when it feels like the opposite of love, too much of the opposite of love, okay. Disapproval or whatever. But yeah, I think when our sense of worth feels to be at stake, feels to be in question, that can be a good place to feel where that happens in the body. And how protective we are. It's like, that's our shrine room, our most secret guarded room, is where we keep our sense of self-worth and how much we deserve and all of that. And so maybe discovering that we all have knees and elbows and emotions and thinking and fluctuating ideas of what we're worth, or fixed ideas of what we're worth. Maybe that discovering helps us feel some other kind of belonging, and we can start to disinvest in all of the activities that are around trying to get self-worth or protect the lack of self-worth or whatever. But just feeling the difference between where there can be a kind of centeredness in the self that's not self-centered. And just noticing that whether we're the pride or the embarrassment, feeling what the self-referencing feels like. in the body. And then feeling what awe feels like in the body. Where it doesn't come up as a question, maybe, in the same way, about our self-worth. Anything else?
I've never really understood this word deathless. Could you say a little bit more about what it means?
One way to play with it is feeling something that comes and goes like the breath. And feeling, okay, here's the beginning of the out-breath, the middle, and here's the end. And now it's utterly gone. Something is gone, and something has continuity. Something. Some non-thing or whatever. There is continuity in some way that's experiential. And the breath example, some experience arises, the energy forms as an experience of out-breath. And there can be attention to that, receiving that experience. And there can be a sense of presence or awareness that has room for that forming of the out-breath and the unforming of the out-breath without any disturbance of its own continuity. Another way would be more of a reflection, like we could imagine, sometimes we can imagine in a more grounded experiential way, when I die, what is my sense of what happens? What is my sense of what may not die? So I think we can kind of explore it in that literal way about death and deathless. It's a word that's translated into English, obviously, that is used in Buddhist teachings and some of the older suttas teachings. To talk about the ultimate. But it's a word that kind of points towards, to me, it points towards, like, let's experience, let's feel what it means, rather than letting it be abstract. And in Zen teachings, sometimes they'll talk about the unborn, or your face or your name before you were born, or before your parents were born. And sometimes we can feel almost a more poetic sense of, yeah, that means something. That's not just purely trying to make a pretzel out of my brain so it stops thinking for a while. It resonates in some way, I think, or it can. And also just letting the kind of actual facts of life be as weird as they are. So that, like, usually we're so in kind of invested in, here I am in my life and I've got to get stuff done. And I either have to do it well or I have to cover up or, whatever the strategies are. I have to do it really badly so I'll get lots of, attention or whatever. But just where there can be a kind of pause and like, God, what a weird body, what a weird thing. Every single thing is weird. We just take it for granted, usually because we're busy trying to make something better or freaking out about some problem or other. But just an in-breath is just bizarre. Or at least it really calls into question our norms, our ideas, you know, like, this is the body, right? But if the breath, just the breath, is much bigger than this skin. Our thinking is like much bigger than the skin. So having another perspective on things we take for granted, and whether it feels more surreal or weird, or if it's more this, that kind of more awe. But there can be like a sense of kinship, of not being this sort of completely only unique. Completely only important individual that our culture would like have us believe. So my wish is that the atmosphere of the retreat will be really helpful for you to enjoy your silence. In a way that makes a difference in your lifetime. And so sometimes, if you've heard about retreats with me or with Open Dharma or deep breath retreats, the news might be, oh, it's really easygoing. It's like, that's the relaxed Vipassana, or that's the relaxed meditation retreat. And I hope that you will relax a lot, like more than you're comfortable with even. I hope so many things will relax that have been troubling you. And others. And I hope also for myself the same. And there so easily can be confusion about what that means, relaxed and loose and easygoing. And so just to be very clear, being relaxed and easygoing and loosening is really helped, like in the way that I'm here for, otherwise I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be here just to enjoy the nature. I wouldn't be here just to have a nice time because my son is in another city and I would be there if this weren't more than just having a nice week in nature. Something more challenging that we need each other for. So in our world, to have 7 days or 14 days where there's not an emphasis on words, there's not an emphasis on reading the newspaper or listening or watching the news, there's not an emphasis on what you think, what your opinion is, actually, about anything. And that's not as an insult. It's as more of like a deep compliment that you're so much more than your opinions and reactions to. There will be, of course, reactions to everything. That's fine, but that's not highlighted. And so not having anybody to talk to about how much you liked or didn't like that thing that we had for dinner or that was in the talk or whatever, anything about the light or the leopard or whatever, helps that to die down and leave more room for nonverbal experience. More room for the shift of perspective, where we get more in touch and connected with what is, instead of what I think about it. And one of the cool things about coming into silence and the mind kicking in is that we can really taste how much what the mind is saying is not really even what I care about. Or even what I believe or think. It's just saying stuff that it's been told, mostly. And so, why listen? Except to really get a sense of the quality shift when there is a real thought that comes out of nowhere, that has wisdom in it, or creativity. So please give yourself that fullness of silence. Because there also is a little tiny voice inside you that it can wait forever for you to get around to listening to it. And that would really be too bad. It's not forcing itself to be heard. And it will not be heard unless we listen. And we can't listen without really good conditions. So please find all the ways of enjoying being in silence together, including the ways that happen of connecting with each other by sitting or lying still with eyes closed without a word spoken. So if it's your first time or if it's new for you to be in silence, then you'll only know by doing it. And so please do it fully. It's not common to have the chance to let the personality really just sort of like hang on the shelf for a week. That you don't have to say, excuse me, sorry, thank you, please. Good morning, good night. How did you sleep? How are you? And so if you need stuff of different kinds, Anetta G and I are here to do our best to serve your practice. So that's why we're here. So let's just come into a restful position for a short meditation, about 20 minutes long. And as usual, it's basically once a day that I give instructions with words, and then the other meditations are in silence. So we'll have that silence now. So you may remember things that I said that you want to experiment with, but feeling how good that you get to feel your own way into your own meditation.